We have one more interesting talk of two great days. We're just going to plug in a new computer. And I have to both read this description and I think ask us to buckle up, because Professor Petzko is going to talk on the subject of the coming worldwide epidemic of neurological disorders and what we're going to do about it. So buckle up.
Yeah, speaking as a teacher, that was terrific. But I got to tell you, if you paid $50 for that bit of software, I'm in the wrong profession, because clearly I should be writing software. I should do what the other speakers did, and I would like to do that, which is to thank Larry for giving me the opportunity to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning yesterday. And actually, come to think of it, you should be thanking me. But having said that, let me now say that if I do my job right, I hope that this talk will help to condense some of the things you've heard in the last 2 days and put them together into a larger framework. And although my original title was somewhat gloomy, I modified it to be a little bit more optimistic, namely that I'm hoping I will tell you it is possible, although not straightforward, to live long and prosper on a graying planet. On this slide, I've colored in blue every country where more than 20% of the world population is over 65 years of age. This is the world that we live in. And this is the world your children are going to live in. If it wasn't for AIDS, this would be blue as well. For 12,000 years, the age distribution of the human population has been a pyramid, with a large number of healthy, productive young people at the bottom, progressively getting to a smaller number of less productive, older, sicker people at the top. And we've built an entire civilization worldwide on the assumption that there will always be a large number of healthy, productive, working young people paying for the long-term care of a smaller number of sicker old people at the top. That's right. Life is a Ponzi scheme. A Ponzi scheme, as I'm sure you know, was named after Carlo Ponzi, who came over from Italy to Boston and in 1920 started the scheme that bears his name. What he did was to say to people, I'm going to go to Europe where postal reply coupons are very cheap, and I'm going to buy those postal reply coupons, then I'm going to bring them across the Atlantic to the United States where they have a higher price, and I'm going to sell them at the higher price and give you a percentage of the profits. This process of buying something where it's cheap and selling it somewhere else where it's more expensive is called arbitraging. Okay? And that's what Ponzi claimed to be doing. What he was actually doing was he wasn't buying and selling anything. He was merely taking the money from the large number of people who came into his scheme later and using that to pay exorbitant returns to the smaller number of people who got into his scheme at the beginning. And as long as more and more suckers bought into the scheme and gave him money to invest, he could then pay off the smaller number of people who'd been in the scheme longer and were expecting their returns. That's the nature of any pyramid scheme. Now, it was Barron of Barron's Financial fame who actually crunched the numbers and realized that for Ponzi to be paying the returns he was paying, he would have to be buying and selling more postal reply coupons than there were on Earth. So obviously, he spent much of the rest of his life in jail and died a pauper in Rio de Janeiro. But every good idea has its followers. And pyramid schemes, which blow up pretty quickly, 13 rounds of most pyramid schemes would require more people investing than there are people in the world, all right, has had more recent advocates. Bernie Madoff was smarter. Instead of letting lots and lots of people buy into the scheme, like Ponzi did, which was why it collapsed rather quickly, he restricted the number of people who were allowed to invest with him, and so was able to maintain his pyramid scheme for longer than anybody in history. And in fact, had it not been for the global financial collapse, he'd probably still be carrying out this scheme today, instead of, as you see him here in his prison garb, which is where he so justifiably belongs. Lest you think that this is a lesson that people have taken to heart, let me show you the latest perpetrator of a pyramid scheme. It is Congressman Paul Ryan. Okay? Whose Republican budget plan is nothing but a pyramid scheme. How many people in this room are under 55 years of age? Oh, good. Because you see, you're going to be paying for my Medicare benefits. See, I'm over 55, and in the Ryan scheme, I get full Medicare benefits. But you, you suckers, what's going to happen to you is when you get to be 65 years of age, you got to buy vouchers. And the vouchers are for private insurance, and they only rise as fast as the cost of living. And guess what, gang? The cost of medical care rises a hell of a lot faster as the cost of living. So you're going to be paying for my medical care, which are going to be great benefits, and you're going to be getting less good benefits when it's your turn. That is a classic Ponzi scheme, and why nobody has told Ryan to his face that that's what he's perpetrating, I don't know. Because that's exactly what it is. All right. That is the age distribution of the human population for 12,000 years. This is what it looks like today. But this is what it's going to look like tomorrow. All pyramid schemes come to an end, and the pyramid scheme that has sustained the world for 12,000 years is about to fall. And this is why it's happening. Since 1840, the life expectancy of a human being on this planet in most of the developed world has increased linearly with no sign of slowing down. During the 45 minutes you sit here listening to me, your life expectancy will increase by 3 minutes and 11 seconds. You're welcome. But I love examples of Petzko's fourth law, and this is one of them. Petzko's fourth law says, that which makes you can also break you. And indeed, this delicious increase in life expectancy runs smack into the fact that, as the Rolling Stones put it so eloquently, what a drag it is getting old. When you hit 65 years of age, your risk for a large number of what Hamlet calls the 1,000 natural shocks that flesh is heir to goes through the roof. I could just as easily have given you the same chart for stroke or osteoporosis, certain types of cancer, or a variety of other things. This is the problem. We're not just going to get a much larger number of old people. We're going to get a much larger number of very chronically sick people. The effect of this is going to be dramatic. Did you know that the fastest growing demographic group in this country are octogenarians and above? Right now, there are about 12 million of them. In 2050, there are going to be 32 million of them, and 16 million of those will have Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease. Just those two diseases alone. And I'm not even adding up stroke, osteoporosis, and the other age-related diseases. We are looking at a ticking demographic time bomb. Right now, just the neurologic diseases, which happen to be what I work on, just the neurologic diseases alone cost the United States every year $333 billion. And for most of them, there is no treatment whatsoever. To put this in its context, what could save us from going bankrupt? All right? Well, we could have global thermonuclear war or a worldwide plague, but we probably won't be so lucky. That would reset the demographic time bomb quite nicely, thank you. But, you know, the trouble is, every time you need a good global thermonuclear war or a worldwide plague, you never get it. Don't you just hate when that happens? So if we're not going to get that, what's left? Well, we could actually try confronting end-of-life health care issues, because you're going to spend more than half of all the money you spend on health care in the last 6 months of your life, and it's not going to improve the quality of your life much on average. So we could actually talk about that in a sensible way and try to think about what to do about it if the Sarah Palins of the world didn't stand up and start screaming death panels every time we try. So unfortunately, though this is what we ought to be doing, this is probably not what we're going to do. And that leaves us with the third best alternative, which is biomedical research. Because the only other thing we've got that might save us from this mess is to make the increased numbers of older people less sick. And that's what I want to talk to you about a little bit. To give you an idea of how badly we're doing this right now, remember that I told you that the cost of all neurologic disorders in the United States was $1/3 of a trillion a year, and that's more, by the way, than the total cost of cancer plus diabetes. Yet we spend 30 times more on this than we spend on this in terms of research. So that right away suggests that we've got a problem. To put this in context, the total United States investment in biomedical research in the last 120 years is less than the cost of either of these sets of diseases per year. So the next time somebody says to you, as they almost certainly will, "God, all that science is really expensive. We can't afford to do it," you should say to them, "You're absolutely right. The only thing worse is when you don't do enough of it. We really can't afford that." And particularly, this is true of age-related diseases. Look at the difference in spending on Alzheimer's disease, for which there are about 500,000 cases per year in the U.S., compared to AIDS, for which there are 50,000 cases per year. Now, I'm not saying we're spending too much money on AIDS research. I don't think we are. What I am saying is we're not spending nearly enough on Alzheimer's disease research. And one of the reasons we're not is that we have not been able to mobilize the Alzheimer's community in an effective patient advocate way the way the AIDS community mobilized back in the 1990s. And we need to take a leaf from that particular book. Okay, so what are the obstacles to getting this right? There are a lot of them. One obstacle is that there are a lot of people out there who are afraid of scientific advances. Okay? And that's partly our fault. We haven't educated them properly. I'll talk more about that in a moment. Another problem is there are religious objections to a lot of scientific discoveries and technologies, like stem cell technology, and that's a huge problem. There's an economic imbalance, as I've just shown you. Science often is low on the totem pole of government and other priorities, industry priorities too, I'm sorry to say. And in many cases, we're spending our money not wisely when we do spend it. This is a real problem. The pharmaceutical industry is falling apart, and it's its own fault. Now, how should I talk about this? Look, I'm not saying I'm opposed to the idea of making money, all right? Thomas Edison invented the light bulb, and the government gave him a patent so he could profit from his invention. That's fine. But the light belongs to everybody, and nobody has a right to turn out the light. It is an established fact that a large pharmaceutical company formed from the merger of two smaller ones will make fewer drugs than the two smaller pharmaceutical companies would have made. And yet not a single pharmaceutical company merger has been blocked by regulators on the grounds that it's against the public interest. And they're all, pretty much, have been against the public interest. And if you don't believe me, check out Pfizer, which has grown bigger and bigger and bigger and has forgotten how to innovate, and compare that with Bristol-Myers Squibb, which has stayed small and has the best pipeline in the industry. But I think, to be fair, we're equally at fault. We don't make their case very well. Scientists who try to communicate with the public are often derided as being salesmen or not somehow not really scientists enough. And we have failed to make common cause with the patient advocate groups, who should be our best friends and allies. We regard them with suspicion. Now, admittedly, I sometimes do worry that people may not see the world the way it really is if they look through the lens of a single issue. But the fact is, the patient advocates are our best allies, and we need to talk to them, and they need to come to us, and we need to come to them, and we need to sit down and find out how we can work together to meet the goal we both have, which is to improve the human condition. It's really that simple. Now, if the federal government has dropped the ball, and it largely has, the good news is there is room for private philanthropy. And if there are people in this room who are interested in this, you should be thinking about it seriously. Because for most of the age-related diseases, the important advances have been funded by private philanthropy, not by government. And I want to particularly call your attention to Michael J. Fox, who, when he got Parkinson's disease at an early age, all right, founded the Michael J. Fox Foundation by initially soliciting contributions from his Hollywood friends. So you can imagine he didn't raise a lot of money that first year. But the first year the Michael J. Fox Foundation started giving grants for Parkinson's research, they funded more Parkinson's research than the government. Now, it was to deal with this problem, and what I've just done is give you my short Al Gore inconvenient truth type speech, that I think the world is facing a worldwide problem, all right, and that we're not treating it as seriously as we might. And it was to do something about this that 9 years ago, my scientific partner Dagmar Ringa and I changed the direction of our entire research group away from structural biology towards what we call structural neurology, which is an attempt to bring to neurodegenerative disease research the tools that we'd been developing over the previous 20 years for doing structure-guided drug discovery for infectious diseases, cancer, and so forth. And this is the team of people currently working on that problem in our labs. They're some of the best and brightest. That is Professor Dagmar Ringa, my scientific colleague. They're some of the best and brightest people around. Now, let me tell you something about the approaches we're taking and why. I'm 62, and so I've started to wonder what happens to your brain as you get older, and I have an adjunct appointment in neurology at Harvard Medical School, so I am surrounded by clinical neurologists when I'm over there, and I've talked to them about this. I said, what happens to your brain as you age, if you have normal, healthy aging? And they said, well, it gets smaller by, you know, a few percent per decade after the age of 40, and it turns brown. And I said, is this a problem? And they said, we don't know. Yeah, right. I'll have the small brain that's been in the toaster too long. Thank you very much. But if you get a major neurologic disease, getting smaller and turning brown would be welcome. This is an Alzheimer's brain from a patient who died of a different cause shortly after Alzheimer's diagnosis. Look at what's happened to it already. And this leads to a conclusion that was alluded to by David Hausman in his talk earlier and that I want to emphasize, which is that by the time a patient presents with most of the major neurologic disorders, there's far too much damage. And although I would not in any sense say we should not be working on things to help those people who already have these diseases, I think the long-term problem of the world is only going to be solved by finding a way to identify people who are significantly at risk for getting these diseases and keep them from getting them. And in fact, this may be an easier problem than treating cancers. Because if you want to treat cancers, you pretty much have to be perfect. You leave a few rogue cells around, they're going to continue to give you problems. But I'm dealing with diseases that hit you in your 60s, 70s, and 80s and take 20 years to progress, unless you're talking about Lou Gehrig's disease. All right? Which means I delay the age of onset until you're 90, I win. I delay the progression 40 years, I win. I don't have to be perfect, I just have to tweak the system. And I think it's actually likely to be easier to tweak the system than people imagine. So how you tweak the system? Well, the first thing you do is to recognize that although the many different neurodegenerative diseases affect very different parts of the brain, they do have a striking commonality, and David Hausman showed you that as well in his talk earlier, namely, in the affected regions of the brain, there are these dense aggregates of misfolded proteins. And the particular protein that makes up the bulk of the aggregate is different with the different diseases, but the nature of the aggregates are strikingly similar, which suggests an underlying pathological problem, and that might mean, that there could be common solutions. And that's what I want to talk to you about. So to understand what's happening, you need to understand that in order to function properly, proteins have to fold up correctly. So think of them as being like an origami figure that has to be properly folded. But sometimes, because this process is inherently somewhat difficult, the protein may misfold. Now, the cell, every cell, contains quality control machinery that recognizes misfolded proteins and either gets rid of it or gives it a chance to fold up properly. But that machinery was designed for people who had an average life expectancy of 35. And we're now living into our 80s and beyond. And that machinery, like much else in the body, can't keep up with the ongoing load of misfolded protein. And what happens is there's a very unusual type of protein in these aggregates. The proteins that are found in these aggregates not only misfold, but they clump together, and when they do, they have the unique and frightening ability to take good proteins and unfold them and recruit them into the aggregates. So the process, once it gets going, begins to accelerate in what William Butler Yeats would call the widening gyre, right? As you spiral down to disaster, more and more protein gets recruited into the aggregates. So I'm going to borrow a Hopi Indian word here, koyanaskatsi. It means life out of balance. What we're dealing with here is an out of balance between the folded and unfolded forms of the protein, so that as you get older and older, the unfolded proteins, misfolded proteins, aggregated proteins accumulate. If we could find a drug that makes the folded form of the protein less prone to misfold and aggregate, then we could go to lomakatsi, which is the Hopi Indian word for life in balance. We would have a balance between the folded and misfolded forms of the protein. And think about the origami figure. When I told you about the origami figure unfolding, if that's a problem, how would you stabilize an origami figure? Well, you could staple it, for example. So what we would be looking for is a molecular staple, a drug that binds to the protein and holds it tighter so that it is less likely to unfold. There's a technical term for that that you may hear sometimes called pharmacological chaperones, but that's just jargon. What they are molecular staples. That's all they are. And that's what we would need to find. And now I want to show you something wonderful. You're one of the few people to see this so far, because it hasn't been published yet. It'll be out in a couple of weeks. This is the three-dimensional structure, which we've just done, of the protein that misfolds and aggregates in Parkinson's disease. It's a protein called alpha-synuclein. And what happens in Parkinson's disease is these different subunits, each of which I've colored in a different color, start to peel out of the tetrameric structure. And so imagine a drug that bound here where all the four subunits come together, or in this pocket here where all the four subunits come together. Such a drug might stabilize this protein and keep it from falling apart. We are now in the midst of searching for precisely such a drug, using the structure as a starting point. How do we do that? How do we find a molecular staple if we know what the structure of the target looks like? Well, first of all, let me show you how that molecular staple has to work. It has to get to the protein when the protein first folds and then stay with the protein wherever the protein goes in the cell so that when the protein's ready to function, it's going to be intact. That's a tall order. So the staple has to bind rather well because it has to survive whatever trafficking the protein may need to undergo. And ideally, you want to design that staple so that it doesn't interfere with any other protein. You only want to stabilize the particular protein of interest, which means you need to design a drug that fits into the pocket the way a key fits into the lock. So there's the surface of a protein, about which I'll tell you more in a few minutes, that's a target for stabilization. Where do you put the drug? Well, my colleague Dagmar Ringa solved that problem 15 years ago, and in so doing invented a science called fragment-based drug discovery, about which I won't tell you more. Suffice it to say, it's one of the things that's made her famous. So we know actually which of the pockets on a protein like this you want to target, and in fact, it's this one here for this protein. But now, how do you find what chemical compound out of the 15 million chemical compounds whose structures are known that might ideally fit into that particular pocket? Well, the answer is you let the computer do that for you. And so here's an example. There's the pocket, and here's one compound. And what we're doing, this, I'm actually doing this on my MacBook Air while we're talking, is docking it into that site and letting it try all different kinds of orientations and let the site relax around it during that process, and at every different step, I'm calculating the energy of interaction. And at some point, I'll find the most stable position for that compound. Then I'll pick the next compound in my list of 15 million and do that, and then the next and the next. To go through the whole list of 15 million would take too long. We have a representative set of about 250,000. To go through those takes about a month to do this right on small computers. It would be faster on bigger computers. And at the end, you get a list. And you take the top 200 compounds of those on that list, and you beg, borrow, buy, or steal those, and then you actually see if they stabilize the protein. That's the way you use structural information for drug discovery in a science like this. And I want to show you that this works. I want to show you by showing you a rare disease. You heard about rare diseases. Here's a rare disease, orphan disease. It's called Gaucher disease. Gaucher disease is an autosomal recessive genetic disorder. It's the most common genetic disorder among Ashkenazi Jews. 1 in 20 Ashkenazi Jews is a carrier for this disease. 1 in 100 in the general population is a carrier for this bad disease. So there are at least 4 or 5 carriers in this room. And I would advise you not to marry each other. Look, where else would you get helpful tips like this? Because should two carriers marry, all right, as here, there is a 1 in 4 chance that one of their children would get this rather terrible disease, which affects every organ system in the body. Now, why am I talking to you about Gaucher disease when I've spent the previous umpteen minutes talking to you about neurologic disorders? I'm telling you this because there are a lot of carriers, as you can see, easy to distribute carriers in the population. And if you're a Gaucher carrier, you have no symptom whatsoever of Gaucher disease. You're fine. You do, however, have a 7-fold increased risk of Parkinson's disease. The biggest single risk factor known for Parkinson's disease is to be a Gaucher carrier. We estimate it accounts for about 200,000 of the 1.1 million cases of Parkinson's disease. You've heard a lot in the last 2 days about subtyping diseases, finding risk factors genetically, and so forth. Here you go. This is a clear-cut risk factor that subtypes a population of Parkinson's disease patients. And what this means is that should we find a drug to cure Gaucher disease, which would be a good thing for about, 50,000 people, that same drug could be used to reduce the risk of Parkinson's disease for Gaucher carriers down to normal levels. And you now know how we do that, because as it turns out, the mutations in the protein called glucocerebrosidase that are responsible for Gaucher disease, all those mutations destabilize the origami shape of that protein and cause that protein to misfold. And so the way to cure Gaucher disease is with a molecular staple for that protein. And I just showed you a moment ago finding the molecular staple. The protein that I was showing you there the shape of and docking a drug to is the Gaucher protein. And in fact, here's its three-dimensional structure in a more easily visual form. And right there in the middle where all the different segments come together is the pocket where we bound the pharmacological chaperone, the molecular staple. And here's a close-up of that pocket. The molecular staple is in blue, cyan, I guess you'd say. And you can see all the different parts of the protein are in different colors, green, dark blue, yellow, orange, and so forth. You can see this drug sits right in the middle where all the different portions of the protein come together. It's a fabulous molecular staple. All right. Let me show you how well it works. So here is a patient with the most common form of Gaucher disease. The normal level of active protein they have should be up around 3,000. The actual level that they have is down around 800. Now we give them the drug. We can get back to about 80% of wild-type enzyme activity in the body. And this molecular staple is now in phase 3 clinical trials for Gaucher disease. And if it works, then there is a chance that we might be able to use it for people who have a risk for Parkinson's disease because they carry one Gaucher mutated copy in their chromosomes. Now, having told you that story, let me tell you another one. Oh, by the way, I just thought I'd show you how effective this thing can be. So here's a mouse. You give them that chaperone and the level of active protein in their brain goes up by a factor of 2. It's pretty tough to get things to work in the brain. This stuff goes in and works. Molecular staple works. And here is the white blood cell from a healthy human volunteer. You can guess who that is. Okay? And on taking this drug, the level of that protein goes up by 3.5-fold. And it stays considerably high more than 2 weeks after you withdraw the drug. So these molecular staples can work very well in boosting the level of proteins, even in this case, in the case of healthy people. All right. Now, let me tell you something that's going to blow you away. It turns out that if you have Alzheimer's disease, your risk for getting many cancers is 1/3 that of a person who does not have Alzheimer's disease. All right. And now that people with cancer are living a bit longer, you can ask the reverse question and ask, do they have a lower risk for Alzheimer's disease? And the answer is cancer survivors have about a half the risk for Alzheimer's disease as non-survivors. This is very particular to a protein misfolding disease like Alzheimer's disease because if you look at other causes of dementia, like vascular dementia, has no effect on cancer whatsoever. But there's no protein misfolding there. There's no origami problem. There's something funny about the protein misfolding disease. Well, maybe it's specific to Alzheimer's disease. No, it's not. Look at Parkinson's disease. This is your risk for most cancers, colon, prostate, lung, and so forth. It can be as much as 1/3 the risk for a normal person. Interestingly enough, for certain selective cancers like melanoma, your risk doubles if you have Parkinson's disease. So it's not all cancers. Most cancers you're protected against somewhat. But there's some cancers you get a vast increased risk for. Now, and by the way, this is also true for Huntington's disease patients. It's true for Fragile X patients as well. Now, I don't know about you, but this looks to me like a really good research problem. So how many labs are working on this connection? I know of one. Ours. Why? Because we have balkanized both the study of disease and the funding of disease-related research by organ system and phenotypic presentation. You got the National Cancer Institute over here. You got the National Institute of Neurologic Diseases and Stroke over there, and they don't talk. You got your oncology department here. You got your neurology department here. Worse, your drug companies are balkanized in exactly the same way. From what I've just shown you, is it not possible that a treatment for Alzheimer's disease might actually be sitting on some drug company shelf as a failed cancer drug? I think it is possible. But the point is, they'll never know, because they would never have tried it on a neurologic disorder. All right. Let me tell you about one more disease. I want to tell you about osteoporosis. This is a really serious medical problem. During the last 10 years, the cases have gone up from 1.3 million to 6.8 million in the U.S. It affects primarily women, but not only. 20% of men get osteoporosis, and pretty much anybody on long-term chemotherapy for cancer is going to have significant osteoporosis problems. There are current treatments, but they have bad side effects, and they don't tend to work on a lot of the people who really need them. Let me tell you something about the way bone works. Bone is constantly being remodeled, and there are two types of cells involved. There are a type of cell called the osteoclast, which comes along and chews up bone, old bone. And then there's a type of cell called the osteoblast, which comes in and makes bone, so that you end up with a remodeled bone. And ideally, here's Koyaanis katsi and Loma katsi again, these things are in balance, and your bone is being remodeled by the combined efforts of the osteoclasts that eat away the bone and the osteoblasts that make new bone, and you're fine. Of course, in osteoporosis, life goes out of balance, and you end up with the destruction of bone, either because you don't have enough osteoblasts or you have too many osteoclasts. It depends on the type of disease you have. That's the way osteoporosis works. Now, we got involved with this problem because of a scientist at Harvard Medical School, Laurie Glimpscher. Laurie Glimpscher asked us to look into the application of structure-based drug discovery methods to a particular target for osteoporosis that her lab discovered. And although I had never worked on bone and had never worked on osteoporosis, I agreed to do this because Laurie Glimpscher happens to be my wife. And believe me, it is only when your wife asks you to collaborate with her on a science project that you realize what Don Vito Corleone meant by an offer you can't refuse. And this was the observation that prompted it. They had been playing around with a gene that was part of the immune system, and they knocked it out in a mouse. And one of the things that happened was they found they couldn't draw the bone marrow out easily to look at. So Laurie told her postdoc to x-ray the mouse, and they found that the bone was much thicker and stronger than it should have been. And in fact, the mouse develops perfectly normally and develops normal bone. The bone structure is the same, okay? The difference is the bone is denser and stronger. There are various ways you can induce osteoporosis in mice. You cannot induce osteoporosis in these mice. They're completely protected. And by a variety of very elegant and clever experiments and scientific reasoning, Laurie's lab had gotten down to a molecular target which needed our help in finding a drug, a molecular staple. And so here is the three-dimensional structure of Laurie's target, and there is the place in the center where the different parts come together that we targeted with a pharmacological chaperone. We'll zoom in on that site now, and let's dock a compound to it. You've seen this before. We're using exactly the same techniques, and indeed, we found a compound that would fit very nicely into that site. And let me tell you what happens when you use that compound. All right. So here is a dish full of naive mesenchymal stem cells. And now you add the compound, and they turn into osteoblasts before your eyes, and they start making bone. Those are little bits of mineral that are forming in the dish. Now, for a variety of reasons, this compound that we found by the docking procedure is not going to be a drug. It doesn't have some of the characteristics that a drug would have. But this result was sufficient to get Merck very excited about this target and the possibilities, and they're actively now working with Lori's lab to develop a better drug to do exactly what you've seen here. Okay. So this collaboration with my wife produced a very successful result. Thank God. But it gives you an idea of how the kind of science I've been talking about may ultimately make some kind of difference to age-related diseases. Okay, look, I don't want this talk to be a downer, so I would like to, although I've tried to present to you that we are facing a very serious situation worldwide, I want to leave you with some positive ideas. There are ways you can reduce your risk for some of these diseases. To reduce your risk for Parkinson's disease, you should know that caffeine actually has a protective effect against Parkinson's disease. Nobody knows why. So go ahead to Starbucks, pay the $30, and have a latte. It's good for you. I would avoid head injury. Head injury is one of the most common causes of Parkinson's disease. And it's significant. We now, by the way, I think understand why that's true, and we're about to publish that. It's quite interesting. It has to do with the relationship between inflammation and that aggregating protein I showed you a while back. But the point is, avoid head injury, okay? Which means you should also wear a helmet if you're riding a bicycle or a motorcycle, and I would also wear it if you jump to conclusions, because, you know, the ceiling's low, and it's not good, all right? I would avoid the avian flu. That's for those of you who are planning on getting the avian flu. Don't do it. For reasons we do not understand, that particular strain of the flu seems to have the ability to get by the blood-brain barrier and infect portions of the brain. And it produces inflammation quite similar to what would happen if you had head trauma in that region. The 1918 flu epidemic was followed by a worldwide epidemic of Parkinson's. Okay? Did anybody ever see the movie Awakenings with Robert De Niro? He played Oliver Sacks, who in a clinic in London in the late 1950s, early 1960s, used dopamine to wake up from locked-in Parkinson's disease people who had been in Parkinson's disease since 1924, when they got it after having caught the avian flu in 1919. Okay, those were people like that. That's what he was waking up. All right. So there is a connection between that strain of the flu and a peculiar form of Parkinson's that can be triggered by infection of the brain. All right, for Alzheimer's disease, we know that omega-3 fatty acids do lower your risk for Alzheimer's disease. It's not known why, but the correlation is a pretty good one. Even better, however, is the correlation with blood pressure. Chronic high blood pressure is the biggest single environmental risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. It is also the biggest risk factor for glaucoma, which you could think of as just Alzheimer's disease of the eye. So if you have problems with blood pressure, get it under control, because this is a huge risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. All right? You should stay mentally stimulated. The brain is like a muscle. You use it or you lose it. But hey, you're at the Gold Lab Symposium, so you're covered for a while. Exercise. Right? I don't know if it's good for Alzheimer's disease or not, but you should be exercising. All right? And clearly, the most important thing for you to do is to support biomedical research. Because look, the theme of the Gold Lab Symposium is time. And what I hope I've shown you is that the clock is ticking for all of our children. Thank you.
We have some questions,
Larry.
Up here.
For several of us.
Yes.
So, Greg, it's always fun to listen to you. And I want to, you said in the middle of all of this wonderful stuff that we've got to get diagnosis early because that's the only hope you have to do things. The first, when Kevin gave the first talk of this thing, a nice bookends for you, he showed us that Jim Watson didn't want to see his APOE4 locus because he didn't want to know about Alzheimer's. Can you tell us about the fear of Alzheimer's and how it affects your plan to get us to diagnose early and act?
So I think the real issue is, can we do anything about the disease once you know you're likely to get it or you have an increased risk for getting it? If you don't have an option, it's not clear to me that it makes a lot of sense for you to know in many cases, especially for something that's so far off in the future. There are things you can do to help lower your risk, but you should be doing those anyway, whether you've got an APOE4 allele or not. So it's simply not clear to me that that's going to be all that beneficial without a correspondence in treatment. So my feeling is that the people like me who are trying to find ways to treat these diseases need to work hand in glove with the people who are trying to find biomarkers. Because it won't do them a lot of good to find biomarkers if we don't give people some options for what to do about the disease. And it won't do us much good to develop treatments if we have to say to the FDA, no, you should apply this to all 350 million Americans. Yeah, after the problem with Vioxx, you're really going to get that approved. Not a hope in hell. So the only solution to our problem is, in fact, personalized medicine. Right? You're going to have to find out who's at risk, what cohorts of patients are likely to get certain diseases. But by the same token, I think in good conscience, you have to be able to say to them, not only do you have a risk, but we can help you. We can help you keep that risk lower than it would otherwise be if we didn't have this therapy developed. I think it's going to take both. No way around it.
Sorry, my question is about your molecular staple with the GoShare.
Yeah.
So you saw that there was an increase in functional proteins.
Yep.
Did you find that there was a decrease in aggregate proteins?
So the answer is yes. In the GoShare mouse, which is where that's been measured very carefully, you not only find an increase in active GoShare protein, you find a decrease in the aggregates of GoShare protein that build up in the lysosome. So you are, in fact, changing the balance on that teeter-totter, exactly as you'd hope you would. We don't yet know if that will work for synuclein, the Parkinson's protein. That clearly is being affected by the GoShare protein in some way or other, but we've not yet studied that as carefully as we need to find out whether the molecular staple will affect the synuclein aggregation. That's ongoing, but not completed. Larry?
Have you equated the low incidence of many solid tumors in people affected, Down syndrome, people with Down syndrome, and the fact that that people with Alzheimer's have similarly low rates of solid tumors?
It's tempting to make that equation, but I'm reluctant to do it because the studies on Down syndrome patients have been done with a very small patient population. If you read those papers, the patient cohorts are like 70 patients, 75 patients. I'm troubled by that. The different studies have not been put together in a detailed meta-analysis in a good way. The data I showed you involved thousands of patients. For the Parkinson's study, about 5,000 Scandinavian patients, and I feel a little more comfortable about those. I'd like to believe that because some of the Alzheimer proteins are contained on the chromosome that's duplicated in Down syndrome, that it makes sense that this would be the case. But the data, I'd like better data. Yeah, you first, then you. I can repeat the question. It's okay.
I've heard about using enzymes to help break down the plaque and scar tissue. And I was just wondering if you might elaborate a little bit on enzymes. But something so simple, and that it can also break down other pathogens that we don't
So the question is, there are some people who have attempted to use enzymes and other things to break up these aggregates of protein. The trouble with that is, the aggregates that those treatments are intending to break up are the macroscopic aggregates I showed you. And it's not actually clear if those are the toxic species. In fact, a number of people, including myself, happen to believe that the big aggregates are the cell's desperate attempt to get the toxic stuff out of the way, and that the actual toxic species are smaller aggregates you don't see. So if you break up the big aggregates in the wrong way, you may actually be making more of the toxic stuff. So I don't particularly favor that strategy, although I'm happy to see some people explore it.
But just in the biological process of breaking down scar tissue, using enzymes, just for scar tissue?
Yeah, scar tissue unfortunately involves a different kind of aggregate, and the aggregates in these neurologic diseases are resistant to those particular enzymes. I strongly suggest omega-3 fatty acids in your case. See, the trouble is you just encourage him, and that's bad, right?
A final question? We see one? I can't see your hand. Okay, yep. Here comes the mic.
So given that more people are retiring, so we've got a smaller tax base, fewer working people, we're paying more for Medicare. I can't imagine that Congress and others are going to be excited about expanding biomedical research dollars infinitely. So given what we have now, you talked about the balkanization of research by funding agencies in our universities and even in our industries. How would you spend our biomedical research dollars better? And just as an aside, talking about Ponzi schemes, thinking about training 20 graduate students for one of your spots is another interesting discussion we could have.
I've written about this, and it hasn't made me very popular among some of my colleagues. I think we need to kill the zombies. There are a lot of zombies in science. These are things that should have died a natural death a long time ago, but still walk among us. And two of them are the so-called protein structure initiative, also sometimes known as structural genomics, which attempts to do the three-dimensional structure of all the proteins in an organism or something like that. That should have died a long time ago, in my opinion. Another are the genome-wide association studies, which look for common variants in the genome and try to associate many of those with a small increase in risk for disease. What I hope I've just shown you is that what we should be looking at are these rare private variants in metabolic diseases, which by definition wreck the proteins that they occur in and thereby have a much better chance of causing you to get a risk for something else. We should be looking at those, not the common tiny variants. Those genome-wide association studies have produced very little of value. I could list some other things, but I think we need to phase those things out as quickly as possible and divert that money into individual investigator-initiated research projects that are aimed at enhancing our knowledge of these disorders. That's one thing I would do. I would also start thinking about ways to incentivize the pharmaceutical companies to work on some of these diseases, because they're not. They're in fact getting out of the neurologic disease game in droves because they perceive the risk of being in it as very high. Clinical trials are really expensive, they're hard to do, and the failure rate has been very, very high. So we need to find ways to incentivize the private companies to do more work on these diseases, because a lot of what needs to be done cannot be done in academia. I hope that addressed your question to some extent. As I said, I don't get a lot of Christmas cards from some people because of this.
All right, thank you. That was wonderful. I just want to say for this five-speaker healthcare delivery session from ways of knowing to ways of doing, I think it was really an exhilarating time. I hope you enjoyed that. I'm going to hand the microphone to Larry after I tell you that somebody lost their glasses and they're up here. So thank you.
Thank you. So I have exactly 2 minutes worth of stuff to say. Could we start with Carissa and Roger coming down here? You have to do that. Come on, don't do that. Come on. Stay away from my daughter. Carissa made me promise I wouldn't do this, but I want to. So, Emily, come on. This is another daughter person. This is for you. And you guys are wonderful. So thank you so much for this. Okay. Thank you. So and there were many other people to thank, and I'm not going to do that because it's time but please understand how grateful I am. There's also on your programs and on these banners people who contributed along with our lab to do this, and I can't thank them enough for doing that. Many of them are around, and so you can thank them when you see them. We picked the date already for next year. It's in your program, May 25th and 26th of next year. And we'll invite every speaker and moderator from last year and this year to come back again and keep this dialogue going. I have no idea what it will be about, to be honest with you. My brain is spinning. There were so many lectures that were transforming for me. And then at the end, or next to the end, I was given permission by Bob to stay confused. He said that. He said I may not know when he was finished speaking what I thought, but I would after dinner, so I'm going to dinner. So, and thank you all for coming.